Welcome to the Full Frame Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Walter. Globally, stress, worry, and sadness have all been on the rise in the past decade. The COVID-19 pandemic has made the situation even worse. According to the World Health Organization, the pandemic triggered a 25% increase in the prevalence of anxiety and depression worldwide. Is mental health the next global public health crisis? Psychologist Dr. Alfie Breland Noble says these unprecedented times are taking a toll on people's well-being. Dr. Alfie is the founder of the ACOMA Project, a nonprofit that focuses on the needs of young people of color. This episode is called Mental Health.
Full Frame.
Public health officials are saying, when we look at the next pandemic, it's going to be mental health. And when we think about COVID, it's kind of percolated all of these kind of sentiments. So can you talk about COVID, what it did to our mental health, and do you see mental health as the next pandemic?
Yes. So mental health was always an issue for all of us. I think what the pandemic did was shine a light on it in a slightly different way. And the slightly different way was that it caused people to pay attention to something that had been hidden in the shadows for so long for so many people. And I think that the other thing that the pandemic did was really sort of percolate and simmer and amplify some things that were already there. So I think these issues of depression, anxiety, social isolation were just exacerbated by the pandemic. And we then had this perfect storm, as I like to call it, of the amplification of these issues, the highlighting of these issues, as well as the exacerbation of these issues. The pandemic just really did a number on all of us in terms of our mental health. And I think what we're going to see coming out of this pandemic is that the next wave is going to be these sort of after effects, the after impact, sort of the results of the exposure to trauma that people experienced by being isolated and locked away and not having the opportunity to hit developmental markers for our young people because they were at home and not in school. Absolutely, that's going to be the next wave, I would say, of our pandemic. And absolutely, the pandemic really did a number on our mental health.
You have a nonprofit. Can you talk to us about its evolution, how you got into it?
Sure. This is a great question. So the ACOMA Project, our name is spelled in all caps because it's an acronym. And it started when I was a professor at Michigan State University many, many years ago. And the idea was there are all these great treatments out there, but if people can't get in the seats to access the treatments, they can't benefit from them. So back in 1999, I was at a conference, American Psychological Association, and then Surgeon General Dr. David Satcher put out this seminal report on mental health. And he's not a psychiatrist, he's not a mental health person, but he was somebody who saw that it was important. So of course, shouts out to our current Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, who says the same thing, is very into mental health. And it got me to thinking about how can I help people access care? Because good care is out there. Culturally competent care is out there. And that's how ACOMA was born. It was really focused on showing people what care is available, showing them the different forms, and then giving them an idea of what's the path to getting to it. So fast forward 20 years. In 2019, we became a 501c3. I left academia. I like to tease, I'm a recovering academic. And when I left and founded the ACOMA Project, we really solidified and built all of our work around three principles: raising consciousness, empowering people, and changing the system of mental health. And it's the same, we do the same work. We're research-based, which was really important to me as a health disparity scientist. And our goal is to ensure that everybody, right? One of the things we say is that every child, every young adult, deserves the right to live unapologetically and authentically as the best version of themselves. And one of the ways you get to that is by understanding and taking care of your mental health. So our goal is to empower young people, young adults, and then have those young people and young adults go back into their communities, particularly in diverse communities, underserved communities, and help the people they care about. Because it often sounds better coming from somebody you know personally, somebody who looks like you, who thinks like you, who talks like you, Because that person can translate it in a way that maybe I can't translate it for that family member, abuela or auntie or tia or whomever. So that's what the Acoma Project's about. That's how we were founded. And it is my life's work. And it is one of the things of which I am most proud.
You said two very important words there, underserved community. You know, we talk a lot in this country about income inequality, but when it comes to mental health, there's an inequality there too, and a huge disparity. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So the disparities I like to share with people, I love how you preface this by talking about the income disparity. That's a part of it. That's a big part of it. That's not all of it. That's not even the primary driving factor. So when we think about epidemiological research, my master's degree is from the School of Medicine at Duke, and we talked about this stuff all the time, health econ. What you find is that for many underserved communities, even when they have the money, people don't access care. And there are many reasons for that. One of the reasons that we know from the literature and from the research and from talking to people is that people worry about how they're going to be treated when they get into that mental health professional's chair, because there are different outcomes by different aspects of identity. We also know that our research literature has not done the best job of developing interventions and understanding mental illness across all different types of populations. So because of that, it's hard to create solutions across different populations if you don't understand the problems across different populations. So these are some of the things that we call psychosocial barriers. Other people call them social determinants of health. These are the things that keep people out of care. And these are the barriers that have nothing to do with money. And so the solutions really have to be focused on better understanding different people's perspectives on how they conceptualize mental illness, what feels palatable in terms of how they address it, and what feels sustainable in terms of what people have access to. So those are some of the things around disparities and how underserved communities in many ways are kind of locked out of having the opportunity to access care, even when they have money or insurance to pay for care.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about this, that the research just isn't there, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, that's why.
Yeah, why is that? It's just.
I think people feel like it's so. OK, I'll give you a great analogy. In the early days of cardiology research, everything was based solely on men. And so our understanding of women's cardiovascular health was like an offshoot of what we learned about men. And then probably 40 years ago, somebody decided, yeah, maybe we need to understand if there are differences that women experience around their cardiovascular health. So you had this whole body of research that developed around women's cardiovascular health. And sure enough, you found that there are some differences, right? And so it's the same thing with mental health research. I think there's this idea that if we just understand it in one group, we'll understand it for everybody. The problem is everybody's experiences are not the same, right? So I think about things like immigration. How many generations has your family been in this country? I think about things like language of origin. Everybody doesn't speak English as their first language. I think about, like you talked about, socioeconomic status and what you have access to. So all of those things contribute to how we understand mental health, both how it shows up and manifests and how we treat it. And we have really failed to do a good job in the United States of understanding these issues for different populations. And that in part is why the Acoma Project is grounded in research. We want to generate the knowledge to help us find the solutions so that everybody feels like they can see themselves in both the issues and in the solutions.
Give us some insights, because most of us don't live in your world, into the marginalized people that you see. How desperate are they? What are some of the issues they're dealing with? And how troubled are they?
So in 2022, we had a wonderful opportunity to put out an executive summary. And then in 2023, we put out a full, and it's probably like a 42-page report called The State of Mental Health of Youth of Color. It focuses on youth and young adults between the ages of 12 and 25. And it's all young people of color, multiracial, Black African-American, Native American, Latino Latine, and Asian American and Pacific Islander. We were very intentional, pretty equitably distributed across those racial groups in the sample. And of the close to 3,000 young people we surveyed, we learned things like about 77% of girls, including trans girls, report symptoms, moderate to severe symptoms of depression and anxiety. We learned that over 50% of all of our young people are reporting in general severe to moderate depression, severe to moderate anxiety. About 20% of all of our young people in the survey reported exposure to racial trauma. And then we dug a little deeper and found things like, when we think about the sources of racial trauma for many of these young people, for multiracial young people, I was really surprised by the highest percentage of all the different sources was family members. And so that kind of knowledge is important because that then gives you the opportunity to figure out where can you make a difference, right? So for a multiracial young person, maybe part of the difference is teaching families how to have better conversations about these multiracial young people in their families. If they happen to be monoracial, but they have a niece or a nephew or a grandchild, maybe there's a different way they need to talk about race. And so we can't do that if we don't ask these young people questions. So I think, you know, there were things that were not so surprising. Of all the young people we surveyed, African-American and Black young people were the most likely to report that the source of their racial trauma, was encounters with the police. And so I think sometimes we think about, you know, for young people, what do they have to worry about? They're young. They're struggling with a lot. And then I think outside of our research, there are people who have done studies on climate change anxiety and how for so many young generation Xers, Gen Zers in particular, they're worried about the planet. Is the planet going to be here when they grow up and when they begin to have children? So they're dealing with a lot. And then we don't even have to get on social media and the exposures that come from being on social media constantly and comparing yourself and seeing all this news that you really don't need to be consuming because you don't necessarily have a way to digest it and cope with it. So, you know, it was very eye-opening for me, but it was also so important to be able to quantify what the lived experience is of young people, like directly from young people themselves.
It's interesting. I was talking to a gentleman on this show not too long ago who grew up in a tough neighborhood, both of his parents alcoholics. So he had the sense of abandonment, depression, ends up drugs, prison, but finds counseling later in life. And it really changed his whole life around. And I think about young people dealing with that intervention earlier in life. As you said, it's not an easy path to go from through the trauma to paradise. But if they start that journey sooner, it can change the entire trajectory of their life.
100%. If for no other reason, then it normalizes the experience of being exposed to trauma, right? It teaches them a language. That thing that happened to you, it shouldn't have happened to you. It wasn't your fault. And, you know, we want you to understand you didn't do anything to deserve it. I think people need that. And then they need to understand at a very young age, there is a path to healing. So it's not just about the destination. It really is about the journey. Because as you described the person that you spoke with, having that counseling at some point later in life taught that person coping skills. Imagine if they would have had those coping skills and an understanding of what it means to be the child of people who are suffering from alcoholism. Imagine having that knowledge very early on. That can help you avoid a lot of pitfalls. So it's the journey in giving you the opportunity to develop coping skills that are going to be life skills. That's one of the things that I think is so important about teaching young people about mental health early on.
But you peel back the onion, you listen to this gentleman tell his story. There's an approach, which is your approach, which is, you know, early intervention.
Yeah.
But then you hear so much in this country, law and order, just lock them up.
Yeah.
How frustrating is it for you to hear these different kind of ways of looking at the same person and viewing them?
Yeah. It's painful because we know that there are some things related to identity that cause people to have these differential responses to the person sitting in front of them. So one of the things I like to encourage young people, particularly young people who are visible, people of color or people who you can visibly really sort of know what their identity is, if they're LGBTQAI+ or if they have a disability. And what I say to young people is you have to understand these things, these difficulties around the isms, racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, they don't happen to you because of who you are. They happen to you because of how other people perceive you. And I think people need to hear that because I think people need to understand that I'm not causing these things to happen to me. These things are happening to me because of other people's behavior. So I can't change who I am necessarily. I can't change what I look like. I can't change who I love, who I'm attracted to, my gender identity. But other people can change how they respond to me. And I think if we can give young people that message, even the young at heart, it relieves a lot of pressure. And I think it gives people the space to really sort of, I don't know, live authentically and be who they are.
Leave on that helpful note and hopeful note, I should say. Dr. Alfie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Dr. Alfie Breland-Noble, founder of the COMA Project. This is all for this Full Frame podcast. Our thanks to my colleagues, Jolie Lee and Brittany Hocker, here in our CGTN studios. And if you want to watch the full-length, full-frame show, please go to CGTN Now on Apple TV. I'm Mike Walter. Thanks so much for listening.